Welcome to Lingthusiasm, a podcast that's enthusiastic about linguistics. I'm Lauren Gorn.
And I'm Gretchen McCulloch. And in this 33rd Patreon bonus episode, we get enthusiastic about how a linguist approaches reading linguistically interesting fiction. But first, it's our anniversary month, 3 whole years of Lingthusiasm.
November is a time where we celebrate another year of enthusiastic linguist podcasting, and we give you the opportunity to celebrate as well.
Most people still find podcasts through word of mouth, and so this month, we'd like you to share any interesting story or fact or linguistics thing that you learned from a Lingthusiasm episode that you find yourself repeating to other people or thinking back on, like, yeah, that was really interesting. Because as people who spend a lot of time with linguistics and have been doing so for quite a few years, we sometimes forget what's actually really interesting to people that we didn't realize everybody didn't already know.
If you have a linguistics fact that you learnt on Lingthusiasm and you love, you can share it on social media and tag at Lingthusiasm so we can help share that with a wider interested audience. Or you can just share a fact with someone face-to-face over coffee, at work, in the car, anyone who is receptive to facts, which I feel like you should know that audience.
Yeah, stories, anecdotes, how things work, explanations of things. Share them with people in your lives or with us on social media. We'll retweet them, reshare them, and help other people get a little tiny taster of what they can learn by listening to Lingthusiasm. If you can't think of one, also keep an eye out for the ones that we're going to be resharing because you can always retweet someone else's as well.
You may also have heard in our last main episode, but we have new merchandise, which is super exciting. I always love when we have new shiny Lingthusiastic merchandise to share.
I am really excited about the glottal bottles, which are water bottles that have the 3 glottal sounds of the International Phonetic Alphabet on them for seriously deep nerddom. It has the voiceless glottal fricative, the glottal stop, and the voiced glottal fricative just there subtly, and then you get to explain that it's a glottal bottle.
What I love most about it is as soon as Redbubble announced that they were going to make water bottles available, we both messaged each other and were just like, glottal bottles, this has to happen.
It really does. I'm really excited about these. Plus, we also have new socks. People have been asking for socks for ages, and now we finally have our 3 main patterns all available on socks.
That's the IPA, cute little trees, whether they're syntax trees or historical trees, and our esoteric symbols in a range of colours.
And of course you can get the usual merch. We also have some new t-shirts. We have some greeting cards in the International Phonetic Alphabet. You can get the usual merch from previous rounds. Also, makes a great gift this time of year. And check that out at the link in the description. So, Lauren, we both like reading linguistically interesting fiction, but I think that's actually huge. What makes something lingfic for you?
I think there's the obvious things, as in, you know, if there's a linguist in a book, linguists tend to get very excited. There are lots of books with...
Because there are so few of them.
People with other occupations in them. But when it comes to linguists, we get very excited when there's a linguist in a book. So that's an obvious form of linguistic fiction. We have talked about Arrival, which features a linguist.
When Arrival came out, like, the linguist internet could talk about nothing else for, like, 2 months. It was great.
Yeah. So that's one of the obvious forms of lingfic.
Yeah, and we also have, like, books that do, like, specific things with language in the book. Like, they have a conlang in the book, or they're written in particular linguistic style. Which, we've done a whole conlang episode. We could probably do even more about this.
I've talked about the work that I've done making a conlang for PM Freestone's work in a couple of episodes. So I obviously highly value a well-thought-out conlang in fiction.
Yeah, one that really interested me was when I read... A Clockwork Orange, which is, of course, many people know, written in this specific style of like a far future English with Russian influences because it was being written in that particular era and of what they thought maybe would be a potential future English. And I didn't so much read it for the plot, to be honest, as I read it for the linguistic experience of starting at the beginning and you read the first chapter or two and you kind of don't really know what's going on because there's all these unfamiliar words. But by the time you get a few chapters in, and definitely by the time you get to the end, you now have figured out what a lot of the words are. And so that process of decoding the words and then going back and reading the first couple chapters and realizing that you did understand them was a really interesting experience to me, independent of the kind of grim and depressing plot, to be honest.
Yeah, so I read that book in the year after I had lived in Poland for 6 months and spoke Polish.
Oh.
And so everyone's talking about this, like, it's so weird to be in this book where you don't understand anything. And I was reading it going, this is all very obvious.
That is a great anecdote.
So not only did I not appreciate A Clockwork Orange for the plot or point, but I also didn't get to appreciate it for the out-of-body experience of reading these words I couldn't understand.
You just got to read this, like, interesting Polish-English hybrid that you're like, oh, some words that I know from a different language are now in this other language also.
Yes, code switching between English and Polish or English and some kind of general Slavic lexicon is a totally normal thing to do.
That is a great experience.
So, yes, definitely read, like, if you are going to make yourself read A Clockwork Orange, definitely do so before learning a Slavic lexical language.
Okay, that's good advice. I have still not learned a Slavic language, so I guess I can still keep reading A Clockwork Orange. For me, it was very interesting because it changed the way that I read books in French. So I read it in high school, and I had been trying to read books in French before, but I would get bogged down because I would try to look things up, like look words up every page and every paragraph, and so I wouldn't get very far.
Yeah.
And so the experience of reading a book and not understanding everything and realizing that after a couple chapters in, I could figure things out, and even if there were a few words that I didn't remember, it turned out okay, really gave me the courage to tackle more full-length novels in French. So that was very formative for me.
Are you a dictionary looker-upper while reading in English?
Not really, and not historically. Like, when I was younger, I didn't look things up at all, and sometimes I formed very weird ideas of what stuff was.
It's interesting how you feel compelled to look up words in a second language, but when you're reading a language that you're super confident in, you're like, whatever, I can, like, figure out from context.
Yeah, you know, I'd be reading something that was from in a historical period that's, you know, very unfamiliar, and I would just not be looking up, like, I don't know, what all of these different styles of gowns were. You know, what's the difference between a, like, chintz fabric and muslin fabric? Like, I don't know, they're both just, like, kinds of fabrics that you can make stuff out of. I was thinking about this recently because I was rereading a book that I read when I was in high school, and I actually did pause and look some stuff up this time, and I was like, ah, that's what chintz is. It's the flowery one that you often make, like, you upholster things out of or you make curtains out of.
I was really disappointed when I discovered what muslin actually was. I'm like, oh, this is not very interesting.
Yeah, or like, you know, I just assumed that people in Harry Potter just like ate treacle tarts and like that's what you ate. And it didn't really matter if I'd never had treacle before.
And it turns out I'm not. Treacle is one of those things that I definitely don't find as tasty in real life. People talk about Turkish delight from The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and then discovering as a grown up that it's actually disgusting.
Oh, the Turkish delight.
Or not to their taste, I should say. I'm sure there are some people who like Turkish delight.
I tried to make pumpkin juice because everyone in Harry Potter seemed to really like it. Turns out pumpkins don't really juice that well.
I can't imagine that would be a particularly pleasant experience.
You had to add like a lot of sugar and a lot of spices, and at that point you're really just drinking the sugar and the spices.
Like I guess a pumpkin latte is what like office workers in Harry Potter, pumpkin spice latte, get through the day. Poor Harry in his middle management position at the Ministry of Magic.
He's drinking just like pumpkin juice lattes. This changes everything.
You're like, Starbucks really is in the Harry Potter universe as well.
Maybe that's where they got the idea they were cribbing from their childhood reading of Harry Potter.
Learning the tools of language documentation, which is the area of linguistics I work in the most, has completely infiltrated the way that I read now, especially a book that has a constructed language. And I have a whole post on reading Kurt Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle, in which he creates a dialect of the island of San Lorenzo where the book is set. And I extracted every single use of dialect in the book and then created an analysis of it.
Did you make like a corpus?
I made a complete corpus. You can, I'll link to that post. And the thing is like, you look at it and you're like, Kurt Vonnegut wasn't really a good linguist. Like, it's clearly some kind of, like, he's Creole no lexified by English. I think it's literally the point I said. Like, he's no Tolkien, but he didn't do a bad job. I can't remember what the plot is about at all, but I can tell you that it's like, oh, there's some interesting lexical borrowing here.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I didn't quite go this far down. I read the Artemis Fowl books as a teenager, and liked them, and they had some sort of writing system around the edges of all the pages.
Oh, yeah, you can actually decode that.
Yeah, apparently you can actually decode it, and I was never quite hardcore enough to do it, but I knew people who have.
I always love when there's just, like, a little bit more for the curious and linguistically minded.
The other thing that I like is reading a book where the author hasn't necessarily gone and said, like, I'm going to go invent a conlang, or, like, I'm going to go do this big linguistic claim on this book. But they've just done something more subtle, linguistically interesting, that you can still appreciate without having the linguistics terminology for it, but that having a bit more background or doing something creative with the narration or the structure or something, I feel like it just makes me appreciate it more.
Having the terminology to, like, message you and be like, oh my gosh, the use of, like, pronoun forms in this book is great, is really satisfying.
Yeah, I especially like, so when I was in school, you know, one of those kind of classic English teacher questions that they would ask us to identify in narration, you know, in reading novels was, you know, is this book written in the third person or the first person? Like, is it written, yeah, I did this, blah, 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 or he or she did this, blah, blah, blah. And this always kind of bothered me because it seemed like there were only two options. And yet, as a person who knew things about languages in general, I would always ask myself, like, where are the books that are written from the perspective of we or us, or from you, or from a singular they narrator? Like, where are these books? Why can't I read them?
You just hadn't found them yet.
Yeah.
They're out there, and they're great.
Yeah, so one that I really liked was, there's a couple of books that are written in the second person. So The Fifth Season and its sequels in the Broken Earth series by N.K. Jemisin was, I think, maybe the first book that I'd read that was written in the second person for large portions of it. Like, you did this, you did this, you did this, where the you addresses a specific character rather than you, the reader. And it was really fascinating to me.
It's probably unsurprising, but as we were putting this episode together, we realized that a lot of our favorite books we had both read, I think, because we just encourage each other to read really good fiction. So, yeah, reading The Fifth Season and kind of, it's interesting because it alternated between you did this, and a kind of standard third person, and then these people went here, and they did this, and they did that. And it was kind of interesting to see the perspective on the narrative change depending on who was talking.
Yeah, that's true, because there are multiple people who you follow through that. And, you know, I don't want to spoil what happens in the later books and how we find out if there's actually a person addressing the you, but it's this really interesting sort of narrative voice. And then more recently, I read The Raven Tower, which I made you read, Lauren, which is also written largely in this you from the perspective of an inanimate entity, the tower itself. And then I read an interview with Anne Leckie where she was like, oh yeah, I was working on this book and I was trying to get the narration to come together. And then I read The Fifth Season and I was like, wait, I can use a you. People don't do that very often. So she was directly inspired by that. And it was interesting to see this kind of connections.
Really?
Yeah.
How interesting. Because I was just like, how have two great authors that I like written books with second person? How fascinating. It's because one was inspired by the other. That makes me so happy.
Yeah, it's not a coincidence.
Wow.
It was literally Anne Leckie reading N.K. Jemisin thinking, huh, maybe this is the solution to my narrative problem. So, yeah, the connection between those two was really delightful for me.
And Anne Leckie has done some thoughtful working with pronouns before, because in her Ancillary series, Ancillary Justice is the first one, which I really love. The main character is a ship AI that can also go into lots of individual bodies within the ship. It's a kind of future sci-fi military setup. And it means that the first person is occasionally like this big mass entity and occasionally just an individual, and it moves between these. And so we have a strong sense of what I counts as, or first person singular counts as in a narrative. And this moves between like something that's more like a first person singular or a first person plural. And it took a while to get my head around it. But again, like, he was playing with kind of the complexity of personness.
Yeah. And the other thing that I remember about pronouns from that book is That the main character, the narrator, speaks a language that doesn't make gender distinction in the third person. And so the main character defaults to she for people of unknown gender and has to really, like, remember when somebody's using a different gender pronoun, which was an interesting narrative choice.
Oh, yeah. Also great.
I should read more books that are written in, like, where the main character just uses singular they as their pronoun. That would be a good idea. I don't know if I have.
I would be very into that. Playing around with pronouns reminds me of To Like the Lightning and that series of Terra Ignota books by Ada Palmer, which we have also both read.
Yes, that was a great series. Well, it's not finished yet. I'm excited for the last one.
I'm so excited. It's set in a kind of future Earth where you recognize a lot of the influences on the culture that exists at the time, but it's set in a kind of it's not post-gendered, it's a much more gender-fluid world.
I think it's a world that has officially kind of abolished gender, but they haven't actually done as good of a job as they claim to have done. And so the phrase of that start kind of cracking as the book goes on.
That's right, because it's a big thing that the narrator decides to gender people.
Yeah.
He's like, people aren't going to like this, but he did this and she did that. And then everyone's like scandalized that this happens.
But he does so in sort of a weird sort of way where he would just like pick a pronoun for somebody based on like weird sort of like sexist immutable characteristics.
Yes. And then that some characters like move between genders depending on their role within the narrative at a particular point.
Another book that I thought did a really interesting thing with pronouns was The Buddha in the Attic by Julie Otsuka.
Mm.
And it's not sci-fi. It's historic. And it's about a group of Japanese women who immigrated to the U.S. in the early 1900s as brides of a bunch of men that they'd corresponded with, Japanese-American men who, like, they, you know, came over to marry and the kind of how they build a life for themselves as part of this.
Right.
And it's narrated in the first person plural, like we did this and we did this. And it gives you sort of fragments of individual stories. You know, some of us settled here, some of us went here, some of us did this, some of this happened. But it's this sort of like combined and fragmentary narrative. So it isn't following one specific person. It's following sort of the archetype of this group of people. And it's this very small book, and it's just incredibly vivid and has really stuck with me. It's been quite a few years since I read it. And it was just this really interesting sort of like, how do you narrate this sort of thing? And it made me really want to like see it performed, because I had this image of, you know, normally when I'm reading a book, I have a kind of mental image of how, you know, the event's unfolding. And normally that's pretty straightforward, kind of like a camera, like you can see some stuff. But because this one was in the first person plural, I couldn't just like follow a character around. And what I ended up kind of visualizing as I was reading it was more like a sort of Greek chorus thing, where you'd have a bunch of people on the stage and they'd be kind of like shouting things out and saying things. And sometimes they'd all be speaking together with one voice. And sometimes each of them would have a line here and there bouncing off each other. But they'd sort of like, they'd all come together and they wouldn't necessarily be representing, like each actor wouldn't necessarily be representing the same character all the time.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing that I think you could really stage. I don't normally read stuff and think, here's how I would stage it. But this one really had a very theatrical feel to it. Not in the dramatic sense, but in the, like, you could do some, like, interesting experimental theater stuff with it.
It's probably also worth saying that almost everything else we've been talking about so far has been sci-fi. And I think the kind of sci-fi I like to read has always opened up, like, possibilities for experimentation with language and fantasy as well. Because they're not set in our reality, people can often be a bit more playful with how things are communicated, or the structure of the world, or the entities that populate the world. And so you can play around more with individuals that are also groups, or towers that speak, or a post-gendered but still deeply flawed world. But it's not to say there aren't other genres that can't also be playful with language.
Yeah, I definitely think that one of the things that I really like is the sort of linguistically interesting sci-fi fantasy bit, because they combine so well. Another book that I've been reading and reading about recently is This Is How You Lose the Time War.
I have just finished reading this entirely on your recommendation.
So good. And it's not so much like, okay, you know, like narratively we're going to play around with this, but it's an epistolary novel and it's, you know, kind of letters between rival spies traveling through time, which is always fun because you get to see how different how characters write their letters and how they construct their letters and what they do with the form of the letter, which is always fun. And, you know, one of the things they do is they use, like, interesting writing mediums to write the letters in. And it's told with letters, and you have two authors who partly wrote the book by writing these letters back and forth to each other, which is an interesting sort of, you know, way of constructing a multi-authored book.
I also do find it really satisfying to analyse a book at the discourse level. So a lot of what we've talked about so far has been, like, sentence choices or grammar choices, but, like, zooming out and looking at a book where you're like, oh, it goes, like, chapter, letter, that's a very satisfying structure.
Yeah, and they do some fun things even at the word level with that. So each of the letters pretty much begins with, you know, dear so-and-so, but, like, the spies' names are red and blue, and so they use synonyms for red and blue, you know, things like Sailor's Delight, which goes with Red Sky at Night, or something like, you know, Cerulean or something like that, for different things riffing off the idea of red and blue, so you get to watch this sort of linguistic creativity embed itself in the novel. But I think the thing that I found so delightful about This Is How You Lose the Time War is that a lot of sci-fi makes things strange by introducing new stuff. You know, like, oh, we've got this technology, or we've, you know, fantasy world, like, we've got this synonym for tea and coffee or something, like, here's our mm-hmm. fantasy beverage, here's our fantasy, like, technology device. And what this book did is it made things unfamiliar by using what felt to me like the kind of the furthest stretches, like stretching the full wings of the author's vocabularies. Because, like, we often don't necessarily use a word that's particularly obscure because, like, oh, maybe other people won't know it or something like that. Whereas mm-hmm. this book, I paused and looked up several words, and this does not happen to me very often in books that are written in English.
I love how surprised you are by that fact. You're like, but I have a sufficient vocabulary to get through most fiction. I don't understand.
And there were, like, several words that I paused and looked up. And, like, I could have kept reading without doing them. The first time I read it, I didn't pause and look them up. But I reread it, and I was like, I'm going to stop and look these words up now, because I'm actually curious about what each of them mean. And, it, you know, it definitely added something interesting to this level of stuff. And it reminded me of reading, you know, Clockwork Orange, or reading, you know, historical stuff, or reading stuff that's set in an unfamiliar era or something, or as a kid, when you don't necessarily assume that you have the sort of familiarity with the world that's required to understand it. Whereas, like, often in sci-fi, if they introduce new vocabulary, they'll put in enough context for you to understand it from context, because, of course, you can't go look it up. But reading historical stuff, especially if you read historical stuff that was actually written in an earlier era, they take certain vocabulary for granted, because everybody in that era knew what this was. And so, of course, you don't need to define it.
I feel like I have this whole bunch of, like, hansom cab horse vocabulary that I spent years reading in, like, Sherlock Holmes and kind of similar era novels that are just like, I've never been in a horse-drawn carriage. I have no idea.
Yeah. Like, what's the difference between, like, a barouche and a gig and a, you know, all of these, like, different types of horse-drawn carriages? Because, like, all of the stuff you read from the era just assumes you know what a hansom cab looks like, even though you're like, ah, I don't know, it's a thing that's drawn by horses, like a stagecoach or whatever.
I have never been a looking things up in the dictionary person, just because I just read and keep reading, and either it will make sense or I'll keep going. But this year I've been doing a lot of reading on my Kindle, because I've been stuck one-handed, and it's a godsend, especially for getting through big books mm-hmm. one-handed. And it has a dictionary function, and it's actually made me more inclined to look up words. So technology has kind of changed how I read in that regard a bit, which is interesting.
Yeah, because you don't have to pause and, like, put it down and pick up a different book. No. Or, like, when I was rereading This Is How You Lose the Time War, I was reading with my phone in my hand because I wanted to take pictures of the pages so that I could tweet about them.
Mm-hmm.
But if I had my phone in my hand to take pictures of the pages anyway, it was pretty easy to, like, oh, I'll just look this word up.
Yeah. Do you remember what the most, like, good work getting that piece of vocabulary in there? That's definitely not a common one.
There was this phrase, apophenic as a haruspex.
That is very satisfying.
Which, those are some great sounding words, but, like, what are they? And so I paused to look this one up because I was like, if I knew what one of these words were, maybe I could figure out the other one. But the fact that I don't really recognize either of them,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to pause and look them both up. So apophenia is this thing where you find patterns in stuff that probably doesn't really have patterns.
Yeah.
So you can use it for kinds of, like, divination or something like this. Like, oh, I'm going to, like, look at how these leaves fell off this tree and divine patterns in this. But you find like spurious correlations between things. And then Haruspex is this kind of like Roman divination role, like priest person who read patterns in animals' entrails and made predictions and prophecies and forecasts that way. And so it's apophenic as a Haruspex is like this thing that this Haruspex priest did, which was find patterns in entrails. Like, I'm trying to find patterns in things that are unrelated. And it's a sort of interesting metaphor for the book at large, because you have these characters called Red and Blue, and they are addressing each other the names of red and blue objects. And reading the book, if you get kind of sufficiently enmeshed in the world, means that you start walking around the world being like, oh, look, it's a red object and a blue object together. It reminds me of this book. And so you're divining patterns into the world that weren't intended to be there. You know, nobody put those two objects next to each other, you know, these two teacups next to each other in a store window or something, just to make them red and blue, just for you to look for them. But you can be divining these sort of connections where no connections were intended, like this sort of miniature phrase that's a capsule of a certain part of the book.
Also makes a great Twitter bio.
Yeah, I think like this should be someone's username or something now.
38, Melbourne, apophenic as a Haruspex.
I don't think it's an accurate description of me. I can't use it. I also don't live in Melbourne, so that's going to be a problem. Speaking of making the familiar strange, another genre of linguistically interesting book is where you have a character narrating it who's not human, especially from the perspective of an AI or something, which is coming up a lot in sci-fi these days.
Thank you to friend of the podcast, Janelle Shane, who put both of us onto the Murderbot series by Martha Wells. It's a series of novellas, and I just...
So good.
When your main feeling about a book is, I read that too quick, darn it. That's always a good review. The thing I like about them is that they tap into a thing that linguists talk about a bit, which is theory of mind, which is when I interact with you, Gretchen, I create this little model in my brain of your thinking brain, and I use that to, like, figure out if I'm telling you a story, I can keep track of, like, what you know about the story based on what I've told you so far and what you might know from the world. That's essentially the potted version of theory of mind. Murderbot is a series of books about an AI robot who calls itself Murderbot and has a very specific sense of its own space in the world, but obviously interacts with humans differently because humans don't go around thinking of themselves as Murderbots.
Yeah, and like, and Murderbot thinks of itself as, like, not having emotions and not having feelings, even though it's kind of evident from the subtext of the narrative that it actually does. But it, like, resents having humans project emotions onto it because it thinks it doesn't have any. And some of these sorts of things that, yeah, like, there's this sort of complicated theory of mind in them.
Yeah, so Murderbot has this complicated theory of mind about what it thinks other people or humans think about it because it's not a human.
Yeah, one of the things that I really like about reading books in general, especially stuff that's told from the first person, is you can sort of get behind the eyes of a character and into their heads in a way that's deeper than you can get if you just, like, watch them walk around a world, like in a movie. You can actually get into what are they thinking as they're walking around. You know, what things that are familiar to them are strange to me, or vice versa.
Yeah.
And a really interesting book that did this was A Closed and Common Orbit by Becky Chambers, which also has an AI main character. And in this case, it's a character that used to be a ship, like a spaceship, space shuttle thing, and then is now in this sort of human chassis body, which it has this sort of disconnected relationship with. It just thinks of as, like, the body, and, like, me is someone else. And so instead of saying things like, I sat down, it will say things like, the body sat down, or, like, the kit, the humanoid kit sat down, even though it's, like, it's the AI making that happen, the narrator making that happen, but it doesn't have this sort of possessive relationship with its own body.
They're also just the whole, there's a trilogy of Becky Chambers' books set in this world, and it's just, it's delightful. Someone summed it up to me as, it's sci-fi set in space, but people are nice to each other.
Yeah, it was really nice to see this sort of cozy sci-fi.
Yeah.
But yeah, this one in particular, the middle book in the series, which, like, you know, definitely read all of them, had this sort of interesting narrative bit because of the, you know, non-human main character.
Yeah. Actually, the person who said that to me was A.E. Prevost, who has been a part of the podcast. So recommendations for books from other linguists always carry extra weight for me.
Yeah, that's true. Anytime a linguist says, like, this is linguistically interesting. Okay.
If you have any linguistically interesting books that you want to share with the other patrons, feel free to leave them in the comments. If you have small people in your life who you want to introduce to linguistically interesting books, we have a couple of steadfast recommendations.
I'm always here to recommend Ella Minow P, which is Ella, like the name, minnow, like the fish, and P as in the vegetable. But of course, it also stands for, like, the letters L-M-N-O-P. And it's a really good story. It was what got me into pangrams, which are those phrases that have that use every letter of the English alphabet, like the quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog. Mm-hmm. And it's also what introduced me to the word epistolary, because it's told in letters, and I cannot recommend it enough.
And I always love Frindle, which we've both read, which is a book about words and how they can create new meaning or change meaning.
Yeah, and like how words get in dictionaries and these kinds of things. And that one's for a little bit younger ages than LMNOP is. But yeah, tell us your linguistic recommendations. We're always interested in more lingfic.
For more Lingthusiasm and links to everything mentioned in this episode, go to patreon.com/lingthusiasm. I tweet and blog as Superlinguo.
I can be found as @GretchenEMixy on Twitter. My blog is allthingslinguistic.com, and my book is Because Internet. Lingthusiasm is created and produced by Gretchen McCulloch and Lauren Gaughan. Our audio producer is Claire Gaughan. Our managing editor is Emily Greff. Our production editor is Sarah Dopierella. And our music is by The Triangles.
Thank you so much for being a patron, and happy Lingthusiasm anniversary to you all. You're the ones that make this happen every year, all year.
And stay Lingthusiastic!